Talk given Saturday, December 4th, 1971. Let us very briefly reconsider certain essential points in connection with pure mind, that is, mind as this transcendent energy, which is immeasurable, which cannot be cognized, observed as an object of knowledge, which is dimensionless and which is formless, whose context, if one may use such a word as context, is in eternity, whose nature is deathless. And let us also consider again this word psyche, which is extremely important in connection with the understanding of karma. You may remember I said the psyche is the receptacle of all the forces and the stimuli and influences which together constitute our karma. Now, when I use the term pure mind or mind only, it will be in the sense of transcendent mind and not mind as we ordinarily use the word in everyday conversation. Now, you may recall, I said mind meets body. That is, pure mind, transcendent mind, meets body, the living body, and gives rise to what we call psyche in ourselves. Mind is universal. Transcendent mind belongs to no one. It is unlimited, altogether unlimited. But psyche is personal. It is, if one may so put it, your particular mind shape. The particular way in which mind functions in you, our mental processes and feelings and so forth, can better be described as our psychical life and processes. You will see as we go on why that is the case. So that psyche is the link in man between pure mind, this transcendent energy, and what we commonly call matter, which means, of course, the body. That must be clearly understood. Psyche is the link between the two. A very real living link. Now, having said that, let us come to this word karma. We can regard it from more than one point of view. On the plane of transcendent mind, karma is creative action, derived from the root kri, meaning to do or to make or to cause, to become, and so forth. And when it is applied in its transcendent sense, it means nothing other than creation. So karma on the plane of transcendent mind means creative activity. It is that type of minding or thought power which brings into being whatever is minded. Simple expression of that, and perhaps one of the best known, is the first chapter of Genesis. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. Instead of using the word said, if we put it this way, the word for God in that chapter is Elohim. It's rather important to keep to that word. And Elohim minded, let there be light, and there was light. And Elohim minded, let us make man in our own image. Make. The ordinary everyday meaning, one of the ordinary everyday meanings of the word karma, again derived from kri, to make, to do. Let us make man in our own image. And Elohim minded this. And as a result of that, as one would see from that first chapter of Genesis, man, male, female, comes into being. The implication therefore is that Elohim is also male, female, positive, negative, container, contained. This is what we are, therefore, ourselves. Similar teachings, of course, come in the Upanishads, especially the very, very early Upanishads, which are sometimes called the principal ones, the major ones. We are made man, male, female. So, this minding is creating. We must get not just the idea, but try and become aware of this fact. Because this fact functions continuously in our life from moment to moment, and we are unconscious of it. Because we are unconscious of it, so much of our unskillfulness in life, our mishandling of our life process, comes into being. Mishandling mainly through clumsiness, not through deliberate wickedness or anything like that, but just clumsiness. We don't know how to do it. So, let us try and get the real awareness of this, that we are created that way. And this has a very important bearing upon the nature of the psyche. This duality in us, which is a complementary duality, not a duality of irreconcilable opposites. If this complementary duality is deeply understood by us, right within ourselves, and we grow into awareness of it in the real sense, so many problems in our life disappear at once, because so many misdoings of which we are guilty every day. I don't mean in a merely moralistic sense, but in a very technical sense. All those misdoings would cease. They'd vanish. It is because this male-female side in each one of us is not in harmony, not in balance, in a dynamic equilibrium, that we muddle along as we do. Now, karma on this plane of transcendent mind has no causation at all. The cause-effect sequence doesn't apply here at all. Because on the plane of transcendent mind, there is no such thing as space time dimensionality. There is no unidirectional movement of time in that whose context is eternity, immortality. Time always means coming into being, changing, proceeding, growing, decaying, dying. Time everlastingly means conflict between duals, sorrow. Time is charged with the sorrow of life. But in this transcendent mind, there is no such thing. There is no such thing as causation. That, in other words, where you have pure creation, creative power in action, there is no such thing as cause-effect sequence. Creative power is creation. It has no meaning. Creative power has no meaning apart from actual creation. Now, it is this kind of creation which is suggested in an Elohim-minded, let us make man in our own image. We fundamentally are like that. And because we haven't woken up to it, and we cannot sort of see it, we are groping in the dark. We are blind children of mortality. No fault of ours, that is how we are. And being like that, we have to grow into this realization. That is the purpose of our existence as human beings. Or at least one of the ways in which we can represent the purpose of our existence. We have to grow into that realization. Remember that that statement was made by a human being like you and I. And he couldn't have made it apart from his personal realization. So, on this plane, there is no causation. There is only eternal creativeness, creation. That's all. Now, this transcendent energy meeting body, this body which evolves out of the animal, produces psyche. And it is personal to us. It is not personal in the sense that your liver is precisely your liver alone. It's not anybody else's liver, apart from transplants. It is your liver, your kidney, your heart, your bones, and so on. But the psyche is peculiar in this way, that it isn't like a physical organ. It is a mental organ. But being a mental organ, it overflows the boundaries of space and time. It is not confined to this body. How is it that we sense atmospheres? This sensing of the atmosphere means, or shall I say, implies, that my psyche is not like my bones inside this body, which cannot function or record anything outside the body. Only if something strikes my body and hurts my bone or just strikes it, then only can the bone be aware of experiencing something. But the psyche is not like that. It seems to be able to put out a pseudopod, like an amoeba might put out a pseudopod, to some very considerable distance. This is one of the peculiarities of the psyche. Nevertheless, the psychical functioning which I have or you have is entirely characteristic of me or you. It is your individuality, your uniqueness, your difference from other human beings. Now, with regard to karma on the plane of transcendent mind, we have said its context is eternity, its nature, its characteristic is immeasurability, and so on. We cannot be conscious of this discriminatively. This is an important point to remember. We cannot be conscious of it. Our ordinary consciousness is discriminative consciousness. We as seeing subjects are conscious of observed objects. Cannot do that with regard to transcendence. That is why if you take the theistic presentations of God, the fine presentations, God cannot be seen or heard or touched or smelt or tasted or sensed or thought of or imagined or conceived in any possible way, because these all belong to the realm of limitation. God, in other words, is a word to represent the infinite, the transcendent, the unknowable in actual fact. But there is this extraordinary thing which human beings can do. We can't be conscious of transcendent mind or God. We can only be transcendent mind. This is the mystery. When all isolative self-consciousness is out, when the whole living being is in perfect stillness and silence, that manifestation, the living being, is the instrument, the focus for transcendence to flow freely in and out. And in that sense, you, the person, are God, are the transcendent. Only in that sense. That there is no more any barrier between oneself and the infinite, between the finite and the infinite, between the self and the not-self, and so forth. That barrier is out. So it's only in terms of being that one is aware. And this awareness is that which transcends the duality of consciousness and unconsciousness. So you see, all these potentialities lie within us. And their realization is the fulfillment, the complete fulfillment of the individual human being. And what plays the crucial part in the entire story is the psyche, the individual psyche. Now you'll see in a few moments how and why that is the case. So, karma from the plane of mind we see as creation. From the on the plane of inanimate matter, we'll use the word inanimate for the time being, purely for convenience. On the plane of inanimate matter, we see causation. In the Newtonian sense, Newton's laws of motion, for example, are an expression of karma. They tell us how action takes place. With respect to any material body or with respect to any force. Action and reaction, you know the famous third law which we all learn at school, action and reaction are equal and opposite. And his first law is that any material body will continue to move in a straight line forever and ever. If it is already moving, it will continue to move forever and ever unless constrained by an external force. This was an extraordinary insight, because there is absolutely no means in the universe of proving that experimentally, because the entire universe moves with me. We can't get a starting point or a standing ground which is absolutely immobile. No such thing. And yet, we accept that first law of motion simply because all that has been derived mathematically and then put into actual practice, the whole science of navigation, the prediction of the movements of the stars and planets and telling when the tides will come, and everything depends upon the fact that that law is true. You see, what an extraordinary insight. So, we have these laws, and so we see here causation. Because here your time sequence enters. That is to say, we human beings are aware of process in terms of time. And that is because we are constituted as we are. If we were able to transcend our constitutional limitation and became aware of time, not only unidirectionally, but multidimensionally, past, present, future would have no meaning for us. We'd see the whole thing in all dimensions, simultaneously. The whole symphony would be here at once, not an unfolding in time, not a succession. The whole business of successiveness, succession, is present for us and a fact for us simply because we, constituted as we are capable of being conscious only in terms of succession. We cannot be conscious, where time is concerned, in terms of simultaneity. If we were conscious in terms of simultaneity, we'd be permanently conscious in terms of the immortal. What we call birth, life, death would be here all together in an extraordinary oneness, simultaneity. So, on the plane of inanimate matter, causation holds. And of course, we have action, therefore, which is no longer just pure creation like that, without consequence or cause-effect sequence. We have action which is conditioned, which is finite, which is subject to space-time, which is measurable, which is mortal, which is controllable by us. We cannot control transcendent mind. It deals unto us always. We cannot do anything with regard to it. It's transcendent to us. It's absolute. We can deal with the relative. And since, on the plane of what we commonly call inanimate matter, action is of this nature, that is to say, we are conscious of it in that manner, we can control it. We can control the energies of nature. We can control objects in nature, and so forth. But now, karma here, then, is mechanical equilibration. The balance has to be kept. Otherwise, there'd be chaos, disorder, complete disorder. In order that cosmos may go on, we must have a mechanical equilibration, keeping in balance. There's no such problem in the realm of transcendence, remember. But here there is that problem. I mean, we know it in our ordinary everyday life. If a steam engines are out. If a diesel engine... when it is going on the rails, does not fulfill what is known as the balancing of the engine, it will just topple over. It's a problem in equilibration. And this question of equilibration comes up in every sphere of our life. In all sorts of ways, equilibration. But it means, therefore, we are confined to duality. So all action in our ordinary everyday sphere of life, where inanimate matter is concerned, is confined, is limited, is under constraint. There's no such thing as absolutely free action. And it is because of this that our ordinary conceptions of karma have risen. This balancing business, this seesaw equilibration. But this is only a small part of the story, and it's inadequately understood, perceived. Because there is no such thing, in fact, as inanimate matter. Matter is very much alive. There are scientists today who, within the last 10 years, if I am not too mistaken, combining Einstein's relativity with Max Planck's quantum mechanics, have produced a new understanding of the nature of matter itself. We commonly used to say that matter at rest has only potential energy. It is not active. Only when an object is in movement that it has kinetic energy. Otherwise it's purely potential energy, position of rest. But now, this theory presents matter in this way. If you take any particle, howsoever tiny, the word particle has to be used, it's not a very good word, but we'll use it. It is perpetually throwing out, creating virtual particles and immediately reabsorbing them. And the speed at which this takes place is of the order of 10 to the minus 23rd of a second, which means 1 second divided by 1 with 23 noughts after it. In other words, this event of birth, death, creation, destruction, or shall we say, death, regeneration in the particle, in every single second of our time, takes place 100,000,000,000,000,000 times. Don't say that the particle at rest is doing nothing. It's a little bit active. Now, there are tremendous significances to understanding this sort of thing. Significances for us. We haven't begun to know ourselves, our potentialities, or the meaning of what it is to exist at all. To be alive. And in the psyche, all sorts of things happen by themselves with such incredible rapidity, of such an astonishing nature, that we are left sort of muddling along somehow. And the crux of the matter is being fully awake to this dynamic poise between death, regeneration, between male, female, positive, negative, this interplay, which is the basic karma, action. Karma means action. That is the actual meaning of the word. So you see, even in this realm of inanimate matter, where we see causation and the cause-effect sequence, where we get these ideas about what you sow that you will reap and all that sort of thing, even in this limited sphere, this sphere of our limited understanding, I should say, this miracle is constantly taking place. Something transcendent shoots right through and through it. And it is because of that that I say that mind, in the transcendent sense, meets matter. Matter is measurable energy. Transcendent mind is immeasurable. Transcendent mind deals unto everything that appears, the entire universe. I can't deal unto it or with it. I can deal only with measurable energy. Electricity, heat, and all that we call matter and the body and so forth. I'm saying all these things, hoping that we can get a feel of the depth and the immensity of this word action, karma. It is a miraculous thing altogether. Karma means action. Forget all the debit, the credit debit, shopkeeping business, the account keeping side of it for the moment. Get at the root of it. Karma, from kri, to create. So now, we know that the idea of strict causation, which held in classical mechanics, is now in this century quite out. There is no such thing as absolutely strict causation, cause-effect. It is true that we use the law of the conservation of mass energy in science for convenience. It works on the macroscopic scale, more or less all right, so that we can run our engines and use our inventions and all the rest of it. But in actual fact, in profound fact, it isn't true. There is this extraordinary creative process indicating that the total universe is alive. There's no such thing as inanimation. And if it is alive, it is growing. And if it is growing, it must necessarily have elasticity. And if it has elasticity and grows, then there is no such thing as an absolutely rigid law. There is no such thing as determinism in the 100% sense. Cannot be. There is sufficient determinism to produce cohesion. Otherwise, no manifestation would be there at all. If there were no cohesion, nothing would ever get together and manifest itself and display something. You get it? Right. Now, the third point of view. Now, we talked of mind, karma, from the point of view of the plane of mind, plane of inanimate matter. Now, plane of organism. Cells. Living cells, to start with. No one less than Sir Charles Sherrington said that if learnability is a criterion of mind, then every single living cell has mind. Now, follow this rather carefully. Every single cell has mind. The potentiality which we human beings call mind. The cell has the power to learn. The living cell has the power of self-reproduction, of self-motivation, and of self-healing. Three extraordinary characteristics. And it has this power to learn. Most extraordinary characteristic of all. What is the human body? It's a marvelous organism, an organization, not a mere mechanism like a machine is, but it's a marvelous organization, an integrated synthesis of cells. So you see, the entire living body has the potentiality, all the potentiality of mind in it. In India, they always described the living person as nama rupa, mind matter, name form. Nama is the Latin nomen, name, and name represents mind. The nomen is an informing principle, actually, in the philosophies of the Middle Ages. I mean the theological philosophies of the Middle Ages. We have this wonderful idea that it is an informing principle. It is also Aristotelian, and of course it is also Indian. The informing principle is nama. Mind is a living reality, just as body is a living reality. So, nama rupa. Now, the important thing to remember here is this, that nama rupa represents not so much a mind, a body, but it represents mentality, materiality. Mentality, materiality. That's the living body. Upon this mentality, materiality, there are acts perpetually, forever and ever, this transcendent energy, which is mind, call it God if you like, call it anything you like. That is this perpetual action. And upon this particular organism called man, which is mentality, materiality, and animal is also mentality, materiality, in its own limits, as far as mentality is concerned. When this transcendent energy acts upon man, this extraordinary thing called psyche comes into being, which is a definite link now between transcendence and the living body. The animal cannot awaken in inner consciousness, enter into profounder and profounder states of awareness, and realize transcendence. You can. I might. See the difference. And the psyche is this extraordinary connecting link between transcendence and mentality, materiality. Now, the roots of the psyche are in the body itself. No brain, nerves, ductless glands, blood, and all the rest of it. No psyche. That is the physical root, so to say. Let us take note of the fact that the word physical is derived from the Greek physis, meaning nature. So physical means natural. And as we have already seen, there is no such thing as inanimate matter. This physical root is not a dead root, so to say. It's something alive all the time, however material it may be. The word material has, in this century, lost its materialistic implication. Material means alive, natural. Whatsoever is natural is alive. And everything that is manifest is natural. So, this nama-rupa, this mentality-materiality, is the physical root or basis of psyche. In man, mind acts upon and interacts with this natural root, and psyche and the psychical life is manifest in us. Now, we can see all this in our personal life as a two-way process. Mind acts absolutely on psyche. I have already spoken about that, so I needn't say any more. It deals unto us. The Dharma operates in psyche in consequence. The law of the spirit, the absolute law, that is Dharma. What old teachers call the eternal order of things, what in the Rig Veda is mentioned as Ritta, from which our English word right, R-I-T-E, the magical right which makes the whole universe run, this creative power and activity. The Dharma is that law. And the word Dharma means fundamentally that which upholds, derived from the root dhri, meaning to uphold. That is the Dharma. That which upholds this perpetual creative action of transcendence. That is Dharma, which upholds it. But you may say, but transcendence doesn't need any upholding from anybody or anything. Creation, which is that through which we become aware of this transcendent creative power, is something which we, out of ignorance or deliberate foolishness, we can oppose it, we can obstruct it, or we can uphold it. So law, in this transcendent sense, is implicit in the nature of transcendence itself. It is when we so open out that we perceive something like the pattern of the unfolding of this creative process, we call that the law, the Dharma, the process of upholding. This is the eternal law. And we have expressed that in the context of religion in terms of absolute or transcendental ethic, not a relative love or wisdom or goodness or anything, but an absolute love and goodness and purity and so forth. This is Dharma in the supreme sense, and therefore it supremely upholds the whole activity of creation, which is karma in the supreme sense of the word. So now, mind acts absolutely on psyche. The Dharma operates in her non-compulsively, non-persuasively. It's very important to bear this in mind. Transcendence never compels. It has no need to compel. It just acts. We have the freedom to oppose it. Or we have the ignorance, the incapacity, because of which opposition takes place. Now all this gets stored up in the psyche in causation terms, cause-effect terms. The impress on the psyche is there. And no impress is lost. we can uphold the law of the Spirit as an absolute morality. Transcendent love, wisdom, goodness, purity, etc. What does that mean in terms of behavior? Take love, if you like. Love is reciprocal between human beings. A person who says or feels that he loves another, whoever the other may be, sort of expects a balance, a return. If that other were not to return or to hurt this person, love may come to an end. But transcendent love is such that whatsoever is done unto this person will always be nothing but love to the other. Now that's the law of the Spirit. It's an absolute law. There is no argument about it, no questioning about it, no investigation about it possible. It is so. So that's one way of the process. The action of transcendence, the immortal upon me, the finite, the mortal. The next aspect has to be seen like this. I have mentioned before that it is helpful to regard mind as the receptive, responsive sensitivity of the living organism. It's a very wide, inclusive definition. This living person sitting here has a receptive, responsive sensitivity, which includes the ordinary sensitivity of the nervous system and all the rest of it. But it includes everything else which is of the nature of sensitivity, which enables this person to receive impressions and to respond. Now, our discriminative consciousness acts as the interpreter of all stimuli that affect us via this receptive responsive sensitivity. Vijnana, the discriminative consciousness, is the interpreter. But my discriminative consciousness has been subjected from the time I was born to all conditioning through two main avenues: natural evolution out of the animal kingdom, and therefore the law of the animal and the way the animal functions is functioning in me, and the other conditioning is my socio-cultural heritage and the actual personal environment in which I was born, grew up, and live, and so forth. Education, the morality we are taught and are expected to live up to, the compulsion of our legal system, and the unwritten laws of our social circle, all the club rules must be obeyed, the dones and the not dones, and so forth. All this is the conditioning influence. Conditioned by natural evolution, conditioned by our socio-cultural heritage. So, from natural evolution, we derive our aggressiveness, fear, greed, anger, the natural urges, as we call them, for self-preservation and the preservation of the species. And from B, the socio-cultural heritage, we derive our prejudices, our preconceptions, assumptions, our partiality We take sides always with anything and everything. Whenever we observe anything, discriminative consciousness, the very term discriminative consciousness means that we are not merely distinguishing the actual fact, this fact as being different from that fact, but we are discriminating and at the same time taking sides with one thing against another. Of course, this doesn't apply, for instance, when you're traveling from one place to another, you have to discriminate between taking this road which leads you away from the place you want to go to and that road which leads you to the place you want to go to. It's not that we are concerned with. But in all that touches our life, our living process inside ourselves, we are constantly taking sides. And therefore we can never have full understanding of all that is there. Because once we have taken sides, we've cut out understanding of that which we are against. Therefore we can't bring about any harmony. And exercising choice. And from both A and B, that is natural evolution and our socio-cultural heritage, we get our state of ignorance. Ignorance in the state, in the sense of non-realization of truth. Not ignorance of technical facts or anything like that. But this awareness is clouded over. The awareness of our real nature, that is clouded over. We have with it selfness and lack of skill. We can't do things. Now, whereas the law of the spirit is absolute, it's a transcendental ethic, our socio-cultural morality is relative, changeable. This and desires, urges, beliefs, thoughts, principles, feelings, aspirations, etc., all constitute the psychical life. In fact, they are the psyche, the greater part of it at least, until they are all transformed. And in the transformation, the specific, so to say, ownership of the psyche by me is gone. Is finished. It's no longer my psyche. My soul has grown into the soul of the world. That is what has happened. The psyche has become virtue itself in the transcendent sense. And in having become virtue itself in the transcendent sense, it receives from transcendent mind all that transcendent mind pours into this person, oneself. That is the state of the perfected Holy One, the state of a Buddha or a Christ or a whoever it be. Now you see what has happened. The psyche is the reservoir of all the karmic forces. It contains the impress of all the stimuli that have come upon it. And all these forces are constantly changing because life is a continuous process. We are alive all the time, which means all the time changing. Now, how does this karma, this accumulated karma inside us, accumulated is a bad word, still we'll use it, simply because the psyche is full of all these forces. How does this karma work out? First note that there is essentially nothing against us. What I mean by that is this. I mentioned that the cells of the body have self-reproduction, self-motivation, self-healing. We have something like 15 million million cells composing the body. Every one of these has the power to heal, to make whole. So wholeness and health is an inherent active force in the body itself. And transcendence is all the time moving us towards holiness. So both transcendence and body are on our side. They are not against us, in actual fact. Now you see why the Buddha said the root of the whole trouble, why all this is ill, is because of ignorance. This person, this living person, is unawake to this reality. Having said these words, we mustn't preen ourselves that, oh, now we are awake, we know it. We have to know in the sense in which Plato used the word know. That which you really know is that which you can do perfectly easily, naturally, unself-consciously. Then you know. The knowing and the doing, or as Krishnamurti says, the seeing and the action are identical. So now, both body and transcendence are on our side, helping us all along the line. Mind and body, transcendent mind and body, are not inimical to each other. They completely cooperate with each other. Put it in another form, nature serves God, not serves in the sense of a servant obeying what his master tells him to do, but in the sense of the female serves the male creatively. Even the animals are like this, but they are enfolded unconsciously in nature's life rhythm. And in that sense, they are perfect. With us, it is different. We have to release this in full awareness in order that transcendent power may work through us in a way which it cannot work through in any of the other kingdoms of nature. Right. Now, our psychical life is the activity which is the manifestation of karma, of all these forces which are at work in the psyche. The power of transcendence works through the psyche. All our conditioning and all our illusions and delusions, our desires, all the conflicting elements are also working in the psyche. So the psyche is this great reservoir of karma, the action process which is our life. You know, we really must get hold of this. I know it's difficult, it's dry perhaps, but it will put the key into your hands and you will know how to put it into the lock and open the doors to fulfillment and realization. If you really see into this. Now, so we see a vast number of influences, forces, act upon psyche, determining our desires, ambitions, likes and dislikes, behavior and actions. And all these are in the sphere of duality, ambivalent in nature, self-oriented. This is because we are unawakened. So we are self-oriented. That is to say, we are conscious of ourselves as separate from totality. We only talk about being part and parcel of the whole universe. But we don't live, we are unable to live, as if that were the actual fact, which it is. Hence the conflict. I'm like the grit, bit of grit in the machine which spoils the machine from working, prevents the machine from working properly. This isolative self-consciousness. And with it is associated fear, self-preservation, and oh, everything goes wrong. All the works go wrong. Right. So now, all of these forces are in the sphere of duality, ambivalent in nature, self-oriented. Hence, conflict, sorrow, sin, death. Death which is the wages of sin. Not death which is the consummator, the bringer to perfection, the finisher, the completer. And in that completion, there is no hitch in the life process from perfection to perfection. This is a great mystery. You see, we are so isolatively self-conscious that we think of, oh, someday I will die and that will be the end. And then I wish that there will be a continuance this way or that way, in some form or other and so forth. You see the great error? Because I am isolatively self-consciousness, death is the unanswerable thing for me. But when I have gone beyond isolative self-consciousness, death is no barrier, no unanswerable obstacle, nothing to be afraid of. It is the divine portal into total being. At present, I am in the state of separate being. Not total, not whole. I am in unwhole being. Now, put it in another form. In the psyche are God and devil intertwined. Intertwined. Not two separate people having a game with each other or sort of struggling for victory over me. Not at all. I am God and devil intertwined. Entangled. This is not a case of disentangling the two and keeping them apart. This entanglement is solved by the transformation of the whole psyche, both God and devil. What made God in me fall into the trap of getting intertwined, entangled with the devil? This is my job, to effect this transformation. This is where my karma works out. In Zarathustrian writings, teachings, they talk of God and the devil in terms of the good mind and the mind which is deceptive. Some translate akemmano as evil mind. I think the better translation, vahumano, is of course the good mind, the perfect mind, transcendent mind. Vahumano and akemmano, the mind that misleads, the mind that deceives, the mind that is caught up in that which is the lie and not the truth. Now, the total power, energy, both transcendent and worldly, that acts in the psyche, and the way it acts is beyond the ability of my brain to grasp or deal with. Now, please follow this very carefully. This vast karmic force, this reservoir of energy in the psyche, which must work out, because a force inevitably produces a result, a change. That is the meaning of a force, that it is continually producing change. Otherwise the word force has no meaning. See? This has to work out. Now, this total force, transcendent and worldly, non-dual and caught within the realm of duality, is something which my brain cannot grasp in its fullness or deal with, ever. Both these, the forces of both natures, the transcendent as well as the worldly, have to have obedience from me. I'm deliberately using this word obedience. This total force constitutes my karma, which ineluctably, it cannot be stopped, that means, ineluctably unfolds the pattern of my life. And you see how the populace the world over, just unable to penetrate into this, to understand it, just throws up the sponge and says, fate, destiny, my karma, helplessly. You see? But this is the fact we have to get hold of. All these energies cannot be stopped from unfolding the pattern of our life. My little brain, my petty selfness and self-centeredness cannot prevent the psyche itself, the reservoir of karmic energy or forces, from operating on and through the whole psychophysical me. Not only does it work upon the body, the forces within the psyche work upon the psyche too, all the time. And they all have to produce their own proper natural result. And as the result emerges, it itself becomes the force which is a cause for the next emergence. And so the thing goes on and on. Now I said, have to have obedience. But if that is the case, man will never be able to progress. Now, you know how people have said, fight the good fight business. which of course is a lesser, it's a lesser stage. If I, having gone through the conditioning of my socio-cultural heritage, see that such and such a morality, such and such a conduct in life, such and such laws, such and such ideas which are fulfilled, say the inequality of men and women, men and women and so forth, I go against that. I am doing something which unquestionably liberates my society, assuming that in course of time I succeed, or there is success to my better idea. It is true that the work I've done is good, but I pay a penalty in pain and suffering, maybe ostracism, etc., etc., for it. Now, this is the great thing we all kick against, don't we? But I'm trying to do what is good. I did nobody any harm. I did benefits to my society and to the world. And look how the world has treated me. It's not that the world has treated me that way. But you see, it is in the very nature of the forces within my psyche, which were forces for a lesser state, a lesser good, if thwarted, to kick back at me myself. And therefore I suffer. You know, this is the crucial thing. Understand this where karma is concerned, and you will be totally free of bitterness, sourness against life, against society, against the world, against all that we call less good or positively evil. You know, this is one of the most terrible things for us to bear, isn't it? We do good, and all that happens is we get kicked for it. But you see, there is no other way. This is how it will happen. Both moralities, the morality of transcendence, the absolute law of the spirit, and the morality of worldliness, which is actually immorality. That is why the whole world is in suffering all the time. You see? Both moralities, which are in my psyche itself, they constitute me, they work out. Because out of vision I see a better, I now say no to one aspect of my psyche. Well, when I say no to one aspect of my psyche, there is an upheaval, there is a conflict, it hurts. Put it that way, if you like. And in outer life, it brings forth situations which are actually hurtful. But if I see that, I really see it, the hurtfulness, apart from sheer physical hurt or torture or whatever it is, you see, by society upon me, apart from that, the pain has gone forever. I know that this will be the consequence. This is the significance in that story, Om, by Talbot Mundy, of the Lama at the end saying, "Now goodbye, I go to my death, because I promised those people something which I have not fulfilled, and the result is that they will kill me." Quite right. Understand this, and you have understood Jesus on the cross fully. Understand this, and you will understand why Moggallana, one of the Buddha's great disciples, is battered to death by robbers. And so on and so on. You'll understand so many things. has been very difficult to bring all this out. And it's taken me literally 6 weeks of tribulation to ferret out this point. This is the crucial point to understand. It refused to find verbal expression day after day, till at last it came right yesterday. Yesterday morning itself. Now, if I am sensible and care for what alone is worth caring for, transcendence, then I will use my power of attention skillfully. I will let karma work itself out, and thus let fulfillment be realized. Now, using the power of attention skillfully, it's extremely simple to present in words. Everything comes to us via the senses, sight, hearing, etc., touch and so on. When you see, when you hear, when you touch, attend to it fully and remain free from attachment and from aversion. To put it in Krishnamurti's form, the way he puts it, do not indulge it, do not fight against it. Attend wholly and completely until the event, the situation, has finished, completed. When such total attention is paid, there is no impress on the psyche which is an unworked out impress, no leftover to be completed tomorrow, day after tomorrow, or 20 years hence. There is no debit credit account. You are free. You are free in your soul. This is one of the profoundest meanings of the freedom of the soul. In other words, you are active, you are doing, you are living completely and wholly in every single instant. And in that freedom, there is complete purity. There is absolute purity. Then you don't have to strive, to struggle, to live by the law of the spirit. The transcendent ethic of this ultimate creative power just works through you. You are like a light in the world. And you are a light because you, the little you, is absent. What is the meaning of karma then? The one and only meaning of karma is left for you then. You yourself, your very existence, is creative action all the time. No problems, no questions about causation or cause or effect or any muddle whatsoever. Free. In the state of duality, avidya, the state of ignorance, leads to ill. Let me be enlightened. And the whole mass of psychical energy, karma, which is the seed of ill, is transformed qualitatively into the seed of absolute good. This is to answer the sort of question that people who haven't really understood karma ask. One of the questions they ask is, but how long will it take to work out all the accumulated karma of the past? How long? That's all. That long. Look, this room is completely dark. I move about, get my finger on the main switch. How long does it take to light up? Much less than that. Isn't it? This is the difference between the enlightened state and the unenlightened state. All this psychical energy will no longer leave one's awareness, one's inner consciousness, in the state of muddlement, suddenly comes through. Now do not think, therefore, that the ordinary pleasure-pain sequence, which is inescapable from physical existence, and its corresponding psychical joy-sorrow counterpart will disappear. It won't. That will remain. That is, that characterizes manifestation, characterizes the fact that we are alive and here. But this working out of karma and the nature of karma is fully understood and fully done. So, from being the karma of almost all mankind is a seed of ill. But with enlightenment, it becomes the seed of the absolute good. This is the whole point. This involves changing my ambivalent, dualistic, conditioned and conditional morality into absolute morality. Always the sealers. Always the pure life. No nonsense about it. The ignorant, the wicked, the fearful, the tragic, the pathetic talk about, oh, don't be fuddy-duddy and Victorian. One is neither fuddy-duddy nor Victorian. When you have seen the truth is the truth. Morality from mores, customs. That which is customary. How often the Buddha has said, it is the custom of my forebears, of the lineage from which I come, to live in body and speech and mind thus. It's customary to live in tune with transcendence. Now, does anyone want to be immoral after that? That is the meaning of morality. And as a last word, whatsoever we may do or think or strive for, you see, in finality, transcendent energy subdues. I'm using the word in its finest sense. Not in its oppressive sense. Transcendent energy subdues, it tames, it trains, and brings into harmony with itself the whole earth. I'm using the word earth metaphorically. All that is manifested, all that is measurable energy.